Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Today, part one of a documentary on how General Motors destroyed the nation's light rail systems and so forced you to buy a car. Something to listen to if you're stuck in rush hour traffic. I hope you'll stay tuned. I'm just back from a trip to New Hampshire. That's 400 miles by motorcycle out and back, taking the blue highways and avoiding the interstate for the most part. That's hardly a heroic journey by motorcycling standards, but each leg of the trip filled up a day pleasantly. Here's something that struck me on the way. Except for a few bicycles and motorcycles, I saw no land vehicles except motor cars and trucks, mostly cars. There's not many Amish in New England with their horse-drawn carriages. I saw no trains anywhere. I don't remember seeing a railroad track, though I probably crossed a couple somewhere. I didn't notice any streetcar tracks, trolley tracks, in any city either. Trolley, streetcar, light rail, I'm using the terms interchangeably. I went past the Trolley Museum in Enfield, Connecticut. It's come to that. As a child, I rode the trolley on occasion outside Philadelphia from Sharon Hill to 69th Street. I thought the trolley was way cool. But today, in most of the country, the only practical way to get anywhere is by car. I'm told that 50 or 60 years ago, you could catch a streetcar in Rockville, Connecticut, ride it west through Vernon, Manchester, East Hartford, into Hartford and beyond. In Manchester, there's now a strip mall where the streetcar station used to be. This happened for a reason. The reason is that General Motors bought up most of the light rail systems in the country, shut them down, and ripped up the tracks. They secretly started a bus company, the National City Line, which operated all over the country. GM made money both building and running the city buses. More importantly, they figured that riding the city buses would be so unpleasant, commuters would buy GM cars instead. It worked. Then they founded the highway lobby to guarantee that all public transportation funds would build highways, not train tracks. And that worked, too. This week and next, we'll hear a two-part documentary on how America was driven from a nation of light rail commuters to a nation of car drivers. A nation of congested roads, traffic jams, smog, and ever longer commute times. It's a film by Jim Klein and Martha Olson, which I have adapted to radio. It's titled Taken for a Ride. Here's part one.
Wow, what a beauty! By golly, I think I'll buy a new car.
The San Diego Freeway southbound's not moving. Well, it's moving about 5 miles an hour.
Fast lane taken up by that three-car non-injury wreck. Look for the usual slow crawl through the Pomona Valley.
We start out on the 60 to the 10. Then we start from 10 to the 210. Then we go from the 210 to the 134. And from the 134, we get on the 5. Spends average of 4 hours a day. It's dark when we leave and it's dark when we come home. We walk in the door, it's dark.
We really be together more than our own family. I mean, for me, I be with them more than I be with my own family.
A multi-car crash blocking the fast lane. Southbound PCH still a struggle from Topanga to Sunset. In Orange County, we got a problem on the 605 at Catella.
This is a story about how things got the way they are. Why sitting in stalled traffic seems perfectly natural. Why our public transportation is the worst in the industrialized world. and why superhighways cut right through the hearts of our cities. This is a story about how the auto and highway industries reshaped America. Brad Snell has made a career researching the auto industry. He spends much of his time here working on a book about General Motors.
How long have you been working on this project?
I hate to admit it, but I've been working on it for 16 years.
Why so much time on one book?
Because General Motors is the largest corporation in the world. It has sales of $125 billion a year. It has operations in 104 countries. If it were regarded as a country, if you looked at its sales and you compared those with, say, revenues that countries ordinarily would receive, it would be the sixth largest country in the world. And yet there's no history.
When you talk about public transportation in America, for the first part of the century, you're talking about streetcars. Trolleys ran on most major avenues every few minutes. Steel track and quiet electric motors made the ride smooth and clean and comfortable. The center of the road was reserved for streetcars, and the new automobiles had to move out of the way.
In 1922, only one American in 10 owned an automobile. Everyone except for the one in 10 who owned an automobile used rail.
Alfred P. Sloan, Jr. was chairman of General Motors from 1923 to 1956.
At that time, Alfred P. Sloan said, wait a minute, this is a great opportunity. I mean, we've got 90% of the market out there that we can somehow turn into automobile users. If we can eliminate the rail alternatives, we will create a new market for our cars. And if we don't, then this whole, you know, the entire General Motors sales are just going to be, are going to be leveled. They had to get rid of the streetcars. They wanted the space that the streetcars used for automobiles. They had to find something they could put in place of the streetcar. Sloan had the concept that he wanted to somehow motorize all the major cities of the country. That meant replacing all the street railways with buses. And ultimately, thinking that no one would want to ride the buses, and therefore they'd buy General Motors automobiles. Sloan wanted to get in very big in this field. What he bought was phenomenal. The largest bus operating company in the country, and the largest bus production company. And using that as a foothold, GM moved into Manhattan. They acquired interest in the New York railways, and between 1926 and 36, they methodically destroyed the rails. When they were finally motorized New York, General Motors issued these ads throughout the country, and this is important because they're trying to show that motorization is the wave of the future. They issued these ads and it said, the motorization of 4th and Madison is the most important and epical event in the history of community transportation.
In the mid-1930s, GM worked hard to create the impression of a nationwide trend away from rail. But there was no trend. Buses were a tough sell. They jolted, they smelled, they inched through traffic. City by city, it took the hidden hand of General Motors to replace streetcars with yellow coach buses. In 1936, a company was founded that would grow to dominate American city transportation. National City Lines had no visible connection to General Motors. In fact, the director of operations came from a GM subsidiary, Yellow Coach, and members of the board came from Greyhound, which was founded and controlled by General Motors. The money to start this new company also came from Greyhound and Yellow Coach. To hide these connections, the company needed a front man. Roy Fitzgerald got his start in northern Minnesota, where he hauled miners and school children in a couple of buses. General Motors would groom him to become president of National City Lines. Over the next few years, Standard Oil of California, Mack Truck, Phillips Petroleum, and Firestone Tire would join GM in backing this venture.
All of a sudden, you get these fellows with the fedora hats, the spats. I'm not making that up. The two-tone shoes, the broad ties, the black shirts, the white Panamas. All of a sudden, they show up. And, of course, the word goes out, hey, we're being bought.
Fitzgerald, big name in buses. National City now in top place as operator of City Route Miles. Prime mover is E. Roy Fitzgerald, who describes himself as one of five farm boys trying to run a few buses.
The Fitzgeralds came in here just like they did in every city they ever went into. They destroyed an established public transit system that hadn't been built to meet the needs of the people.
Oh, the streetcars, we love riding on them. And it was fun because they were big, you know, there was plenty of room and all that.
We'd catch them at the same time every day. We'd know the conductor, and you'd meet people that you'd see every day. And you weren't afraid to talk to someone.
The streetcar was fast, isn't it? He just jumped on the chairs like that, it was so fast. And then the conductor, every time he would come to a crossing, he'd go clink, 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 clink.
For the trolley cars yourself?
Oh, yeah, J-car, yeah. I was there.
They were around when we were younger.
That was the best form of transportation. Then somebody had the bright idea to take up all the tracks and get rid of all the trolleys. That's when the headache started.
How long did it take before the Fitzgeralds started getting rid of the streetcar?
About 90 days. No, I'm not being facetious about that.
Weren't those streetcars making money in Los Angeles?
Well, after I got done chopping their heads off, we made money. Cut the miles down. Sell off the properties. Pull the company down.
They don't take the service out. They just cut it back. They'll take it and they'll cut it from 10 minutes to 12 minutes, from 12 to 15, from 15 to 20, from 20 to 30. So they reduce the service. And every time you reduce the service, you make it less attractive. And the less attractive, the less riders. And then they say, well, see, we can't make any money. So they abandon it.
People told me you went in there and you fired everyone off when you went there.
That's right.
Why'd you do that?
Well, if you don't need the people, what are you going to do? Keep them around for flies? There was people on there who was up for retirement. And you always get rid of the old ones first. Yeah, that's what we do.
Barney and Eric was just like everybody else of that particular ilk. All they were interested in doing was taking the money out. They sucked the system dry. They raised the fares. They skimmed every dime's worth of everything they could get off of it. Basically, I'm bitter at what I've seen. Because if you take a fine tool Rolls Royce, as an example, and give it to some shade tree mechanic and let him work on it, and he ruins it, you're going to be bitter about your Rolls. And that's what we had, was we had a Rolls Royce. We had the finest public transportation system in law, I think, of anywhere in the country. And in 10 years, that was just history.
National City Lines grew quickly. By 1946, they controlled public transit systems in over 83 cities. From Baltimore to St. Louis, Salt Lake City to L.A., two buses in Eveleth, Minnesota, had grown into an empire.
The appearance was always that this was only a company that was owned by the Fitzgeralds. You know, these people that had come from Minnesota with no money at all, and all of a sudden they're in control of this, you know, multi-million dollar enterprise. But in fact, money was coming from the corporate sponsors.
To the mayor, to the city manager, to the city transit engineer, and to the taxpayers and the riding citizens of your city, you are entitled to this warning. There is a carefully, deliberately planned campaign to swindle you out of your electric railway system.
Commander Edwin Quinby was a rail buff with a talent for financial sleuthing. In 1946, he mailed a warning to influential people in hundreds of cities across the country. His 33-page broadside was filled with surprisingly detailed research. It brought to light what General Motors had worked hard to hide.
The plan is to deliberately destroy public utilities, which you will find impractical to replace after you discover your mistake. Who are the corporations behind this? What is more important, why are they permitted to destroy valuable electric railways?
Industry propaganda disparaged Quinby.
Queer Case of Quinby by Ross Schramm. Edwin J. Quinby took full advantage of the great American privilege of the free press to feed the lunatic fringe of radicals and crackpots springing up like weeds in the United States today. The document, printed on cheap paper, is natural fertilizer for suspicions, for disunity. What is the Quinby pattern? Was he used by some strange political influence?
Edwin Quinby's efforts did not stop National City Lines, but the cat was out of the bag. In 1946, the Justice Department began an antitrust investigation into National City Lines, General Motors, and the other investors.
It appears that National City Lines and its manufacturing associates have entered into a plan to secure control over local transportation in important cities in the United States. If these companies are permitted to continue their program, they will soon have a stranglehold over the industry.
The key lawyers involved in the case told me there was not a scintilla of doubt that these defendants, General Motors and the others, had set out to destroy the streetcar system. But since there was no antitrust law on the books at that point saying thou shalt not destroy streetcar systems, that the best way, the only way that they could get them on a violation was to proceed along the criminal antitrust conspiracy route. And that's what they did.
The government's case was straightforward. National City Lines, General Motors, and the other defendants were found guilty of conspiracy to monopolize the local transportation field.
These companies that had probably eliminated systems that in order to reconstitute today would require maybe $300 billion, these companies were individually fined $5,000. And the individuals involved, like the treasurer of General Motors, who had actively run Pacific City Lines, one of the subsidiaries, and was a major moving factor in all of National City Lines operations, he was fined the magnanimous sum of $1 at the conclusion of the trial.
The Justice Department would spend the next 25 years trying to limit GM's influence on transportation. It would begin three major investigations into monopoly practices. Two were settled out of court. One was eventually dropped. An effective way to rein in General Motors was never found.
Things are looking up for civilian car buyers, but don't rush out to get one now. This sample will not go into production for 2 or 3 months. When Detroit overnight...
The post-war years were an auto executive's dream. After 15 years of depression and war, returning GIs had money in their pockets, and they were eager to get on with life. Federally subsidized mortgages favoring new homes encouraged an exodus from city to suburb.
These are the 36 men who built this house. Another day, another 40 houses.
And, of course, every new suburban home needed a brand new automobile. But the cities were at a crossroads. During the war, despite the efforts of National City Lines, streetcar ridership reached an all-time high. Factories ran round the clock, and so did the streetcars. This heavy use left track worn to the nub and trolleys worn out. It was a moment of choice. Rebuild the trolley lines or watch them die. Europe and Japan rebuilt, but America's privately owned transit companies resisted such a costly investment. There was public pressure for cities to take over and bring the rail systems up to date. But by now, National City Lines was a model for a cheap and easy way out. Across the country, private operators followed its lead.
Los Angeles.
Elimination of the big red cars and substitution of buses are necessary to keep the railway out of financial hot water. 13 of the system's 19 rail lines will have to go.
Los Angeles had two streetcar companies, one owned by the Fitzgeralds, and the other, the Pacific Electric Red Cars, that were the pride of L.A. There were hundreds of trains a day, and downtown, a subway. 1,000 miles of track linked the beach to the mountains and connected scores of communities to downtown.
Roger Ehrenberg, Los Angeles Assistant City Attorney.
You say that you used to ride the red cars.
Yeah, I rode them every morning, and many of us would play bridge or something while we were going down, and they preempted the major intersections, so they were fast. I certainly preferred them to the bus. In fact, as long as it was possible for me, I always rode the cars.
The fate of the red cars was front page news for more than a year. The public was outraged.
A blistering attack was laid down today by a group of civic leaders. Attorney Marshall Stimson told the board, "You're not going to solve Los Angeles traffic problems by turning loose hundreds of buses to stink up the air, slow down traffic, and tie up the streets." A survey of San Fernando Valley citizens showed 88% want rail passenger service retained.
Pacific Electric needed heavy ammunition to get their plan past the Public Utility Commission, so they brought in Arthur Jenkins. Jenkins had been chief engineer of the commission, and he was highly respected. In the past, he'd supported rail improvement. But in 1946, Jenkins began working with the Fitzgerald brothers. His position quickly changed.
There's only one fundamental issue involved, and that is whether or not Pacific Electric should be permitted to follow the course already established throughout the country of replacing obsolete rail passenger service.
To what extent did you consider the noxious fumes which would result by the substitution of motor coaches?
I gave a good deal of consideration to that. Actually, there is no harmful effects of the fumes, and numerous tests have been made on that account.
Some of the buses stunk so bad I couldn't ride them. They made me sick, actually.
Do you think the buses did add to the pollution?
No, there's no question about it, very dramatically. If you go down, even today, go down in any street where there's a bus line and follow a bus and see how long you last.
The State Public Utilities Commission yesterday granted the Pacific Electric the right to use buses instead of trolleys on most of its suburban lines. It probably will take 3 to 6 months before the big red cars stop rolling.
Every street almost in Philadelphia had a trolley line. I don't care whether it was second and third, fourth and fifth. The line just went up and down until it got up in the north, and then they would branch out.
Every north-south street had tracks, and more than 50% of the east-west streets. There was a change in management. There was a concerted effort to maximize the use of the bus.
Philadelphia was the last big city transit system to face National City Lines. The antitrust case had forced GM to sell its stock in National City, but the Fitzgeralds continued to tear out trolleys, and General Motors continued to provide the buses.
In keeping with the vigorous spirit of the new Philadelphia, PTC has completed a $36 million modernization program, spearheaded by the purchase of 1,000 new diesel motor coaches. A story of diesels and dollars.
They come in and they started to cut. And they cut everything in this brother. As the new buses came in, another trolley line went.
One story I heard The newly appointed vice president handed the superintendent of the department a list and said, these are the people that I want you to fire today. And he brought them in one at a time, told them they were done as of that minute, clean out your desk, leave. When he was all done toward the end of the day, he went back in and he said, okay, here's your list back. They're all fired. And the vice president said, good, now you're fired.
National City Lines never came in to make the system any better, in far as what I read and from what I know. Their idea was to scrap properties. We sold everything. Almost everything we had was now sold.
Before the big change, all but six of the city's 30 main downtown arteries were handicapped with streetcar operations. By the end of December 1957, three streetcar surface lines were all that remained in the downtown area, and only 14 in the entire city.
Newsreel film shows a huge fire incinerating dozens of decommissioned trolley cars.
I could see what was happening. They did it in Baltimore. They did it in Philadelphia. They did it in Los Angeles. Come in to do a job. And 5 gallons of kerosene went with every trolley car. Put a torch to it, and that's the way it went. Now, you stripped everything. They don't have to stay. Once they sell you buses, it'll perpetuate itself.
We've heard the first part of the documentary, Taken for a Ride. We heard how General Motors intentionally destroyed America's light rail systems, with a little help from its friends. Next week, how the same scoundrels created the highway lobby to ensure that the transportation system would get only worse and worse. But enough gloom and doom for this week. We'll have plenty more next week. Thank you for listening to New World Notes. On the web, we're at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust advising illegitimate non-carborundum. Put a tiger in your tank. Ask the man who owns one. See the USA in your Chevrolet. Or better yet, don't. And please come back again next week. Happy motoring!